Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, as Democrats criticize President Bush's request for $87 billion more to fund the continuing cost of occupying and rebuilding Iraq and Afghanistan, other defense spending has also come under fire. The Peace Action Education Fund announced the creation of a nationwide advertising campaign last week, linking what it calls the administration's dubious pre-war claims of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction with plans to develop a strengthened U.S. nuclear arsenal. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with Peace Action spokesperson Kevin Martin about the group's campaign.
The title of the ad, you know, I think encapsulates the timeliness of it. And it says, "We found the weapons of mass destruction. They're in the president's budget." And so it ties the shameful lies about the war in Iraq that, of course, those of us who opposed the war knew from the get-go that it was all a bunch of lies, with a current hypocritical drive by this administration develop new types of usable nuclear weapons. And so on the one hand, we supposedly fought a war, which again was based on lies, to stop the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and we go around the world selectively yammering at other countries saying you can't have nuclear weapons, while at the very same time, our government is pushing forward to develop new types of nuclear weapons. And it's just it's a breathtakingly bad non-proliferation policy.
Where has your ad run so far?
We're targeting states that have key senators for an upcoming vote in the United States Senate, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. The ads ran in Maine, Oregon, and Nebraska, so pretty much three states in different parts of the country, and we're also looking at a few more states.
Who specifically are you targeting, and what action are you calling on readers to take?
The six senators that are targeted in the ad are considered to be particularly important swing senators, Senators Snow and Collins from Maine, Hagel and Nelson from Nebraska, and Smith and Wyden from Oregon. But I think all senators should hear from their constituents about this. It's not a lot of money, but the problem is the signal that this sends. And, of course, the United States has had a do-as-we-say, not-as-we-do non-proliferation policy for a long time. But it's so obvious and so stark right now in the wake of the war in Iraq and with what we're doing, being very concerned and raising international concerns about North Korea or Iran or other countries potentially developing nuclear weapons. And here we are, you know, planning to add new types of nuclear weapons to our arsenal when we already have 10,000 nuclear warheads.
Could you speak a bit more about the Bush administration's specific plans to strengthen its nuclear arsenal? What exactly is it pushing for, and what dangers do you foresee this presenting?
Sure. And I should say that I want to be an equal opportunity critic here. It's not just all on the Bush administration. These programs were all under development under the Clinton administration, and Bill Clinton and his folks didn't intercede to stop any of these from going forward. There's a so-called robust nuclear earth penetrator, or bunker buster, which a lot of people talk about, and they say they need this to burrow underground and explode a bunker where some terrorist or Saddam Hussein or somebody might be hiding. The fact is that the independent studies show that it actually would not work. It wouldn't be able to burrow underground, as they say, and it would cause terrible radioactive fallout. And there have been estimates that if this were exploded in an urban area, at least 10,000 people would be killed. So it's a very dangerous weapon that we're talking about, not some kind of pinpoint accurate weapon. They're also talking about so-called mini nukes, or smaller, more usable tactical nuclear weapons, which, again, sends a very, very bad message to the rest of the world that we're trying to develop more usable nuclear weapons. We're trying to lower the threshold for using nuclear weapons. They also want to start a new plutonium production facility, and the only reason you would need to do that is if you're ramping up your production of new warheads. This facility would produce new plutonium pits for nuclear warheads. And the last of the four programs that are being pushed right now maybe is the most alarming in the long term. They're trying to decrease the time that it takes to get the Nevada test site ready to do full-scale nuclear test explosions again. The United States hasn't done any full-scale nuclear tests since 1992, when the first President Bush was in office. And the rest of the world looks at this and thinks the United States is getting ready to try to start nuclear weapons tests again. And most people in Washington who follow these issues think that if Bush gets reelected, they will push hard to start new nuclear tests again, which would enrage the whole world. I mean, we saw worldwide condemnation of France when they restarted nuclear testing in the mid-90s. And I think given the international climate right now, with so many countries so angry at the United States for our unilateralist empire-building foreign policy, if we move to start nuclear testing again, there'll be a firestorm of criticism all over the whole world. So these are very dangerous policies, even though they're only first steps, and it's not a lot of money in the budget. But as we often see with programs in the military budget, and particularly nuclear weapons programs, once they turn on the spigot and the money starts flowing, it's very hard to turn that spigot off and shut these programs down. So right now is the time to stop these programs.
Now, in addition to bringing a firestorm of protests, do you foresee this as potentially starting a new nuclear arms race?
Exactly. And, you know, that's exactly the wrong direction that we need to be moving in right now. You know, American foreign policy, and particularly the Bush foreign policy, is so at odds with the rest of the world right now. And this is certainly only one example. But the United States, instead of starting a new nuclear arms race, should be leading the world towards nuclear disarmament. And we're the country with the huge nuclear arsenal of 10,000, and we're the country that's the unchallenged world military and economic and political superpower, and we're not using that power to the good. We're looking at, you know, small increments of how we can maybe increase our military here or there, and actually they're not that small. But we're seeking to gain advantage where there's no need, and it's, again, likely to provoke worldwide reaction and a new nuclear arms race.
And what do you see as the significance of all this with North Korea in the backdrop?
Well, a lot of people who look at U.S. nonproliferation policy would say, and I would agree, that we have very little credibility in terms of our nonproliferation policy. But North Korea, you know, I think these policies, but also if you look at what just happened in Iraq, and to be clear, I don't want any country in the world to have nuclear weapons. But if I were North Korea looking at what just happened in Iraq, and if I were Iran looking what just happened in Iraq, and if I were Syria and other countries, the lesson I would have learned is I better darn well develop nuclear weapons very soon to protect myself from a global superpower that's out of control and that decides that it can be judge, jury, and executioner and invade any country anytime it wants to. So it's not just these nuclear weapons programs. Our whole foreign policy is sending the wrong message to not just North Korea or Iran, Iraq, but frankly the whole rest of the world.
So, Kevin Martin, you're calling on concerned citizens to contact their senators to support Senator Dianne Feinstein's bill then?
Yes. It's going to come up in the Energy and Water Appropriations Bill in the Senate very soon, and Senator Feinstein's amendments will be to cut the funding for these new nuclear weapons programs. So everyone should be contacting their senators. There's a toll-free number, 800-839-5276, and telling them to vote in favor of Feinstein's amendment against the new nuclear weapons program. And there's much more information you can find out about these issues and the vote, and you can see the ads that we're running on Peace Action's website, which is peace-action.org. I just think that this is an important time for citizens to speak up, and I think because of the growth of the peace movement in this country and around the world in reaction to the horror of the war in Iraq, that we're in a much stronger position than we maybe would have been a year or two ago, and I think right now is an important time to speak out against these atrocious policies of our government.
Kevin Martin is a spokesperson for the Peace Action Education Fund. His group's ads will run later this month in the mass transit systems of Washington, D.C., Chicago, and San Francisco. Well, as we commemorate this week the second anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Centers, we turn to award-winning investigative journalist William Thomas, who asked, what exactly is terrorism? Thomas spoke several months ago in Vancouver, Canada, at an event sponsored by the group Necessary Voices.
What is terrorism, anyway? If we think of terrorism as innocent people frightened for their lives and for their safety and security being coerced into the agenda of armed aggressors, if that's our definition of terrorism, then I would have to look south to the biggest terrorist regime on this planet. Not by my definition or say so, but by their own actions. It was Hitler who taught the world that if you tell a lie big enough and repeat it often enough, it becomes reality for many people. This is called conditioning. Hitler did not have access to the sophisticated mass media that we have today, saturating our airwaves and our mind waves with lies that are so ludicrous, our mind starts to bend. It all started with 9-1-1, of course, September 11th, and we were told this is America's new Pearl Harbor. And you know that's true, but not in the way they meant. If we read a book by Robert Stinnett called Day of Deception, and we look at the radio intercepts, the interviews with the radio officers working at the time, they said, oh yes, we track the Japanese fleet all the way across the Pacific. And when Admiral Moore in Pearl Harbor got very nervous because the fleet had disappeared from Japan and Washington was not relaying its position, he sent the American fleet out there, carriers, heavy cruisers, and he intuited the position that this fleet was arriving, and he was 1 week early. And when he ordered his scout pilots to fly out and search for the fleet, they would have found it. We would have had a very different world today, but the admiral in charge of the scout pilots refused to fly the mission. And when Washington heard that the ships, the American warships, were out there, they recalled those warships immediately to Pearl Harbor. And they ordered all other traffic, including commercial vessels, out of the North Pacific because they didn't want this fleet discovered before it launched an attack. Roosevelt needed to get the Americans into a war that on December 6, 1941, 85% of that population said they wanted nothing to do with. The memories of World War I were too strong. So indeed, 9-1-1 was a replay of Pearl Harbor. Yet another deception, another facilitated attack. Not planned in Washington, but foreseen and facilitated. We had no warning, we were told over and over again, from a White House whose phone had been ringing off the hook literally for months. As the German BND intelligence service, the Russian intelligence service, the French, the Israelis, Mossad, and so many others repeatedly warned Washington, a group of terrorists are going to hijack airliners and fly them into the symbols of American wealth and power. Those warnings, of course, were ignored, and not only that, John O'Neill's anti-terror task force sent FBI agents to 5 flight schools throughout the United States, making inquiries about Arab flight students. Every one of those investigations was quashed. And when the agents complained, they went all the way up the ladder to John Ashcroft, Attorney General of the United States, and he ordered those investigations stopped. And they had one gentleman in their hands, Mr. Massawi, who they captured in Minnesota, wanting to learn how to fly heavy aircraft without bothering to learn how to take off or land. He was caught with several passports, Boeing flight manuals in his car. The French called up and said, hey, you've got an Al-Qaeda agent there. You better check this guy out. The FBI was not even permitted to go into his computer, and they did not interrogate this gentleman. And we know now that those terrible events of September 11th could have been stopped on not one but several occasions. That network could have been rolled up before it happened, but those investigations were blocked. Perhaps we could ask Richard what happened. Richard Myers, who was acting head of the air defense for the United States on that morning, wasn't in his office, and he said, gee, you know, nobody even told me about this attack until my meeting ended. I went out in the hall, somebody had a cell phone, and they said, hey, guess what's happening? So he wandered over to the Pentagon, and on September 13th, he was hauled before the Senate, and they said, General Myers, exactly what happened, and when did you launch the alert aircraft sitting on the runway at Andrews Air Force Base, 12 miles away from the White House, routinely launched whenever a single airliner strays off course? He said, I don't recall. I don't remember. I'll have to get that information. I think it was just before the Pentagon was... No, maybe it was after... I'm not sure. I'll get back to you on that. Of course, he never did. Well, the answer is that those two jets, the armed alert interceptors at Andrews, sat on the runway all day long, and they weren't launched until that evening. The interceptors that were launched some 12 minutes after the alert was given were launched from Cape Cod, 179 miles away. I've been a pilot, and I've done the mathematics, and if those jets had accelerated to their full speed of 2,000 miles per hour, they would have intercepted the second airliner before it hit the South Tower. They would have had 1 minute, which is an eternity in air combat. They would have had at least one pass, maybe two. But you know what happened? When those pilots requested permission to go to full afterburner, that permission was denied. Now, the idea there was, gee, if you do that, you might break some windows. So the pilot said, well, can we go out over the Atlantic? It's just off our left wingtip, accelerate, and get down there, and permission was denied. That comes from the squawk box, the radio relay in the ready room at Cape Cod. But we weren't told that, were we? And the Army general and the Navy admiral in charge of the defenses of Pearl Harbor, who were kept completely in the dark from an attack that just about everyone else in the military knew was coming, they were court-martialed, and there were several investigations. General Richard Myers was not court-martialed. He was not even reprimanded. He was promoted to the head of the Joint Chief of Staff, the head of the entire U.S. military, the military that is now in Iraq.
William Thomas is an award-winning investigative journalist and former reporter for the Environmental News Service. We'll have more of his speech later this week on Peace Watch. Finally, tonight, with the second anniversary of September 11th, sure to invoke renewed calls by the Bush administration for expanding the war on terror, we're going to hear throughout this week on Peace Watch from people seeking more peaceful alternatives to war. Among them are members of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Filmmaker Francis Anderson produced this documentary about how the group was formed and how it seeks nonviolence as a tool for rebuilding a more peaceful future.
The past is prophetic in that it asserts loudly that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows.
I'm just telling my mother that everything will be all right. And I just know that everything's not all right. And I'm like, well, you know, maybe he got out and I'm sure he's fine. You know, and I'm looking at this thing, he's not fine. You know, I just know he's dead. I know he's dead.
I was at my desk and it was about 11:15, I think. And my sister Mimi called me and she just said, Colleen, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but Billy was in the World Trade Center. And I just remember screaming, no, you know, 100 times, probably 100 times. And not wanting to believe what was going on.
And then in the morning, there was a knock on the door at about 8 o'clock. And it was two men in uniform, and they said, we are here to represent the United States government and to let you know that your husband, Craig Scott Amundsen's status in the United States military is at this time unknown. I just sat down and realized that it was pretty likely that I wouldn't be seeing Craig again.
There is no scale on which my family can begin to measure our loss, nor are there any words to adequately express our sorrow. My family is quite clear, however, that we would never want another family, whether Afghan or American, to feel the way we do now.
I am hurt that the United States is moving forward in such a violent manner. I do not want anyone to use my husband's death to perpetuate violence.
Let us grieve, let us reflect and pray, but let us not as a nation add to the inhumanity of our times, not in our son's name.
My brother Abe Zolmanowicz was on the 27th floor of One World Trade Center when the first plane hit. It is in my brother's name and mine that I pray that we, this country that has been so deeply hurt, not do something that will unleash forces we will not have the power to call back.
One day we must come to see that peace is not merely the distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal.
Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness.
A number of us were so moved when, while we were really still pretty incoherent, we began to hear some statements that were coming from people who had just lost their loved ones and were still in the midst of acute grief. And it just seemed as though one statement would come out after another.
So I called Voices in the Wilderness, and they were planning this walk from Pentagon to the World Trade Center.
Barry and Ryan had started emailing with a couple people, including David Pitordi, And then we were invited by Voices in the Wilderness to go on this walk for peace.
I turned to Ryan and said, we're going from start to finish. We're doing this.
Tell us why you decided to join in this march.
Well, I really felt like I needed to do something to get our voice out, our family's voice out. A lot of people just assume that the families of victims want vengeance, and we don't necessarily.
December 1st, 2001. The March of Families of September 11th Victims enters downtown Manhattan.
We're here to provide healing and to provide an avenue for people who aren't comfortable with what's going on to speak out and join us and help us create some sort of a change so that we don't lose anyone else.
Masuda Sultan is an Afghan-American who had 19 of her family members killed in a U.S. attack. She spoke January 11, 2002, at a fundraiser for a peace delegation to Afghanistan organized by the group Global Exchange.
These are people, too. They're human beings. They have the same desires as we do. They have children to feed, and they go to sleep at night, you know, wishing for the best, just like we do. And that they are really trying to survive. And this, I just can't help but think of the account that I was given of that night when they went to bed, thinking that they were safe, and waking up to bombs falling on their houses and running out of their houses and being shot at by helicopters hovering above. I mean, it's just an unbelievable account that they give. I don't know what to say. It does make me feel a lot better to know that there are people that care, that can see beyond what we're being fed by our government and our media, and that we'll take the initiative to research a little bit more and see what's really going on. I can't really say too much more. I'm sorry.
January 15, 2003, Masuda Sultan, Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, and September 11th family members Daryl Bodley, Kelly Campbell, and Rita Lazar visit Afghanistan.
Recognition is what, why I'm here sitting with you right now. When I understood the symmetry, I knew I had to come and do more than just say we have to help these people. I had to bear witness for my brother. I had to be his eyes.
An Afghan describing the scene as he stands in front of homes destroyed by an errant U.S. bomb on October 24th, 2002.
It was the U.S. bomb that on that time U.S. wanted to bombard other parts, and it was an accident that here was two bombs was filled in here and 9 people was died.
Can they take us?
Yes, this way.
Yeah.
My daughter died when she was 20 years old. And so I understand that your son was about the same age. I didn't know until later that she had died. She was far away when she died. But the pain is the same. So I'm sorry for your loss. You come all this way to see another person who's had the same thing happen to her. Something came out of the sky and killed her child. I don't think my daughter died the same way. In some sense, she knew what was going to happen. She was on Flight 93. I don't think they knew what hit them. That's a little different. But it's still the same pain afterwards.
In front of the U.S. Embassy in Kabul.
We have met with many victims of the U.S. bombings. They're all very happy that we have gotten rid of the Taliban, but they are suffering tremendously. And then this morning, I met Khalifa. And I'm going to skip all the details of the other ones, because after September 11th, the U.S. government, the American people, and everybody in the world poured love and affection and money on us, the victims of September 11th. Then we come to Harifa. She comes from the same situation I come from, and she goes to the U.S. Embassy with a description of what happened to her family. She lost 8 members of her family, and she tries to hand in a letter explaining what happened and asking for help. And they turn her away and say, go away, you're a beggar. Can you contrast that with what has happened to me? And how can I walk away from that situation? So when I go home on Thursday, you're going to hear about this nut who is going to stand on every corner and go to Congress and stand on every desk and scream at our politicians, you must help these people. We can't wait for appropriations that take 2 years. We have to help them now. They're desperate.
A Peaceful Tomorrow's press conference, February 14th, 2002, at United Nations Plaza in New York City.
Martin Luther King Jr. said that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. And we're using that phrase as a guide to announce the formation of a permanent nonprofit organization called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Even though we are all obviously different ages and we come from different places, we all share a common bond in launching this organization. We are all seeking effective alternatives to war as a response to the September 11th terrorist attacks.
Peaceful Tomorrows will be helping to try to get our government to set up a fund for our Afghan sister families.
It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do.
And our hope, our great hope, is to use our memories of our loved ones to heal and to search for peace in this fragmented world.
And I tell people, well, I have no more moral authority than anyone else. It's just everyone has the same amount. It's just they haven't woke up to it yet.
Just wonder.
You know, anyone can get out and say, this is what I feel. This is what I believe.
Peaceful tomorrows begin with what we do today.
Steps to Peace, the journey of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. It's produced by Francis Anderson and Pomegranate Films. For more info on the group, visit its website at www.peacefultomorrows.org. Stay tuned to Peace Watch the rest of this week for more nonviolent responses to war and terrorism as we commemorate the second anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA and David Pittori. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.